This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
The prosecution built its entire closing argument around a very specific detail, the detail only the killer would know. Richard Allen confessed to seeing a van drive past during the attack on Abby and Libby, according to the prosecution, and then, you know, said he killed him with a gun. That van that the state told the jury belonged to a real neighbor who really did drive that road that afternoon. Case closed, according to them. Except the defense obtained surveillance footage showing that the van arrived significantly later than the state's witness testified, and FBI cell phone data pointing later still. The state's answer is that the paperwork wasn't filed correctly. Not that the content was wrong, it's just you didn't quite meet the bar. You didn't cross the T dot the I on the minutia of it. Now that the data is wrong, and separately documented in the defense's own brief, Allen also told his psychiatrist that he had shot the girls. They were killed with a blade. The state's 94-page response never touches that detail. In this segment, we're going to be talking about what happens when the centerpiece of a prosecution may not hold and the confession meant to prove it got the most basic fact of the crimes wrong. Let's start there. The prosecution told the jury only the killer would know about the van. That was their proof. The confession was real. If the van didn't arrive when the state's witness said it did, if it arrived after Libby's phone had already stopped moving, what does that do to the entire foundation of that argument that it was built on, Bob?
It guts it. You know, the only the killer would know argument is one of the most powerful tools that a prosecutor has when they're trying to validate a confession, right? I mean, it tells the jury, this man knew something that wasn't public, something that only someone who was there could know, right? And that proves the confession is real. So when the prosecution pointed to Allen's mention of the van and tied it to a real neighbor who really did drive the road, that road in particular, it was catastrophic for the defense. And the detail was, really supposed to make everything more credible for the state. And I think in the eyes of the jury, it did. The problem for the state and for reality is that there existed this particular piece of evidence that didn't come in at trial, that came out during post-conviction when there was a document called a motion to correct errors that was filed. And in that motion to correct errors, they attached this video that showed that Weber, and that's who was driving the white van, he was getting off work from the Subaru plant, which is in West Lafayette, which is anywhere between 20 and 30 minutes. So you have the time of death, which the state is assigned as like around, I think 3:22. And then you've got Weber, them saying he's driving down that road. So that means in the state's theory that if you're to believe Richard Allen's confession with the details only the killer would know, that he sees the van, it spooks him, and that's when he decides he has to kill the girls. Okay, so that happens in and around 3:22 as a result of him seeing the van. Problem is, during the motion to correct errors, they find this piece of evidence that was turned over by the state. Okay, this wasn't something that the defense dug up. It came in the discovery, unfortunately, for whatever reason, but probably because it was a huge amount of discovery and tons and tons and tons of video, hundreds of hours, and they went to trial quickly because they felt that they were concerned that Allen wouldn't survive to get to trial. So they really pushed it and they forced it to trial. In my opinion, I was really hoping that they were going to delay it because I knew that there was more stuff they had to get into. But that van shows Weber actually driving down that access road at 3:44 p.m. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that kind of absolutely obliterates the state's theory, doesn't it? But the state's concept was, okay, well, that, we see that van, but we can't trust that timestamp and you have no way to prove it. But my rebuttal to that would be that the FBI and their cell phone data showed that he connected to his Wi-Fi at 3:50. Mm-hmm. So I think that corroborates that pretty well in terms of when he drove down that access road. So, man, I mean, it's another one of those things that, I really hope the appellate court is going to dive into, because I have to say it. I mean, the elephant in the room with regard to the appeal itself is that it exposed a lot of deficiencies in terms of what happened at trial, in terms of the defense failing to preserve appellate issues by objecting at trial. Okay. So, I mean, that's a reality.
Yeah.
That's a reality. A lot of times the appellate courts are going to look at it and be like, all right, I see that the state has argued 94 pages of the merits. However, their initial argument is the correct one, which is that they waived it. It's not before us because the defense failed to failed to object at trial. Because you can have the situation where you have a pretrial hearing, right, on a motion, and you fight. And that is noting that there's an issue, and you mm-hmm. can file a motion to reconsider to the judge, and the appellate court can know that you have an issue with it. The problem is you have to restate that objection at trial. And it appears, and I haven't read every bit of the record, this is going to have to be addressed to some extent in the reply, where they're going to have to go through the record and see if they can kind of work through, like, okay, well, they did object to this, but like when the things like the gun came in and like things that they had objected to through the Franks memo when they were asking for that, where they were attacking the search warrant, where they recovered these things mm-hmm. like the jacket and the gun. And so they're obviously saying, we got a problem with this. We think Liggett came in and lied in order to get that order, that search warrant. And at that point, when they introduce it into evidence, the defense had to object to it again. Mm-hmm. And the problem is in the record, this one, I know they said, we have no objection. So that's going to be the problem with this particular issue and this appellate brief, is that for those issues in particular, and we're talking about like the first two things we've been talking about are, there's basically four issues in the appellate brief that Allen's lawyers filed. The first two of what we've been talking about. And I have to say, we had a pretty amazing panel last night, and I'm going to kind of promote me a little bit here.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I had Andrea Burkhardt and Allie, who are two of the most brilliant attorneys that I know, defending the appellants, which mm-hmm. is Richard Allen's brief. And then I had Michael Osbrook, who was an equally brilliant attorney who does habeas work, which is post-conviction work, and has an unbelievable win rate. The guy's brilliant. And I had him put on the white hat because he used to be a deputy attorney general back in mm-hmm. the old days. So he had been in that position. So I had him. And even though Michael is actually the one who wrote the motion to correct errors in the Delphi case, so he's well equipped. And I knew it was putting him in an awkward position to have to argue for the state on this. And, you know, and during that debate, and that's how I did it. I was the moderator. I had him on a clock. I had him on a time. It was really a fascinating exercise. But I think everybody kind of came to that conclusion that those issues, and Michael said it definitively, that are going to be dead in the water. The appellate courts are not going to give some kind of leeway because they see that the importance of the merits. They're going to say, look, we're going to hang our hat on the easiest thing we can, and which is that you waived it and it's not before us. So, I mean, that's a reality that that everybody needs to know. Anybody mm-hmm. that follows the case, that I want people to understand that on those first two issues, I think they're dead in the water, even though I think the reality is that they're incredibly important issues. And I think that it's a real shame that they're not going to get addressed in terms of the merits of the issue.
Sure.
So,
and I want to get into some of that in our next segment about, you know, what's going to be coming up next here. Yeah. I want to hit on this, just kind of going back to, cause this is an element that always kind of gets me, where, okay, he saw the van. I mean, this is their argument that they're trying to make. He saw the van and that spooked him. And then that's why he killed the girls.
Yep.
Huh? I mean, like, you saw a van, then you decided must kill the girls? Like, okay, and number one, how the bodies were found. I mean, then did he give him a bath and then clean him up? And I mean, like, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make logical sense. It doesn't make physical sense for the way they were found. And for him to have done all of this in this short period of time. I mean, it's just a very simple, saw the van, killed the girls. Let's say it out loud and keep repeating it and we'll all believe it. But if you actually just look at the, I mean, number one, the timing, that's a whole other part of it. But if just the, from a psychological standpoint, what?
Like, no, it's not the way it works.
It's like, why would that be the lever that he pulls?
And that's not a panic escalation in those moments. No, anyway.
And he killed the girls. And again, that's why he killed the girls. That's where he shot the girls, according to him. And they were not shot. So that's why he killed the girls, even though the method of killing is, all of it doesn't make sense.
And it gets worse than that. Because it's, then you introduce Sarah Carbaugh, who says that she sees Bridge Guy or a muddy and bloody man. It like after 4 o'clock, which means that Alan does this incredible thing because he sees a van. He feels like, oh God, I may have been spotted. I have to now kill the girls to like make things even worse for me. Other than the fact that somebody just saw me with two girls. Now I'm going to murder them both. And then I'm going to run around the woods like some kind of wood imp.
And I'm going to jump in with this panic escalation. Because the panic escalation here, as they're claiming it was, he saw the van, so he said, I got to kill the girls fast. Last thing you do is take out a knife. You got the gun in your hand, supposedly. You shoot them, then run.
Yeah.
I mean, because the first impulse when you panic is fight or flight. Run. If he thinks the girls witnessing him there is going to be an issue, you don't stab, declothe, clothe, drag. I mean, you just go. I mean,
in the middle of the day, by the way, on a nice hiking day where a lot of people are out, you're going to do all this and this get no blood on you. And the girls are cleaned up magically. Their blood seems to be gone for the most part, too. And it's like this. None of it makes sense. It's like, okay, tell the story. And then you look at the evidence like, well, that doesn't add up. Like,
yeah. And Robin, let me ask you, as a former Fed, retired Fed, you see that guy's picture, you can see his hand. All right. So that's not a guy who is suited up to not leave DNA. If you've got a guy who Sarah Carbaugh claims is muddy and bloody, and that is in fact the same person who just killed the girls, if that guy has their DNA all over him, I guarantee that guy would have his DNA all over them.
Both. Oh, yeah.
And I mean, Alan's DNA isn't anywhere to be found anywhere in these two brutal murders.
Yeah.
Can you explain that to me as if I'm five so that I can understand how that could happen, Robin?
It can't. And well, and we have a comparison contrast right now. Just look at the Nancy Guthrie case. What did that guy get sued up in? You know, and this just goes to that arc of you don't go from I've never sexually abused or killed kids to all of a sudden I am. And, you know, from 0 to 100. But let's say for a chance that we just don't know about those other cases. Right. Then you have at least one or two reps. So you're not going to wear that outfit. You're going to look like the guy on Nancy Guthrie's front step is suited right up. He's got gloves on, you know, leaves no DNA trace, or even a Koberger, you know, same thing. That's Koberger's first attempt at it. What's he dressed like? All you saw was the big bushy eyebrows. You know, so this is not what someone wears to do that. He is slumbering across a bridge, you know, out trying to get his thoughts together because he's going through a stressful time in life. You know, just
Here's another thought on it. Okay, I know it was several years after when they went into Rick's house and they took the jacket that they say is the jacket of Bridge Guy, which again, that's a whole other part. Like, why is Bridge Guy the murderer? Like, there's no real evidence to say that he is, other than that somebody thinks they heard a gun. It was a guy walking across a bridge. There's really nothing that connects the man to the death of these girls, other than a video where they're confused as to where they're going and goes down the hill. Suddenly, that means like I'm a mass murderer and I kill you and I'm wearing a Carhartt jacket. Woo! If he did this, and in this crime would have been very bloody for whoever did it. The girls were certainly cleaned up by the time where they were found. Yes, you could technically clean a jacket in the course of all those years. What did you have? I mean, I would guess there'd be some DNA residue somewhere within the fibers of that jacket that there ain't no amount of Tide with bleach that's going to completely get out, no matter how well you do it. And you're still hanging on to the jacket all those years later. The jacket that you killed those kids with, you just couldn't part with. You couldn't go buy another one for $79.99 down at the Atwoods. No, we're going to hold on to the murder jacket.
And
there's no evidence on it.
Now, so let's just, now we can go down down that road, you know, do a little thought experiment. Yeah. All right. So let's say he held on the jacket. So why do people hold on to things? Well, because they're trophies, so they can remember it, you know, because this is what serial killers do, but this isn't a serial killing, but this is what murderers do. They hold on to trophies if they're going to hold on to something, and then they covet it, they secrete it in a secret place, because we were talking about secret places yesterday, so that you could actually keep it private, keep it just for you, for your mental, you know, little gyrations you're having. He didn't do that. It's hanging in a closet.
Yeah. It's a normal jacket he's wearing. I mean,
the state's answer for that has been that they found the round in his keepsake box. That was – so theoretically, you'd have to take the logical leap that, number one, Alan knew that he – so this is where you have to go with this. So, again, for him to not have left DNA on the girls, that means, as Tony said, that he would have – you know, okay, let's pretend he did – he cleaned the girls. He went to the great lengths to clean the girls. However, he racked the gun again.
In the creek?
Down there. but Clee goes to the great lengths to clean the girls. But then after he racks the gun, he decides not to pick up his round. Okay? And he leaves that smoking gun piece of evidence in the state's world at the crime scene. And then that means in their world, he'd have to be aware of it in order for him to assign any kind of actual meaning to the round that they found in the memory box. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because yeah. if he drops the round, he's not aware of it. There's no significance to him keeping a round in his box to remember it, because the gun didn't really have anything to do with the crime. Right. So it has to be that thing where, okay, he racks his gun, the gun pops out, he goes and cleans the girls, or at least he cleans Abby, because
yeah,
you know, Libby was still very bloody.
Yeah.
You know, and then forgets about this round. You know what I mean? But you can't have it where he's aware that he ejected the round, decides not to pick it up after he cleans up the rest of the crime scene, and then goes home and he's like, oh, you know what? I'm going to keep a round from the same magazine, and I'm just going to keep it in this box so I can always have that memory. It's incongruous, man. It doesn't work. You can't, again, you can't have it both ways, because it's like if he unwittingly leaves the round at the scene after he's cleaned up everything else, that round in the box would have no significance because he's not aware that he left a round there. You know what I mean?
You know,
it wasn't the murder weapon.
I know. If he lent a shot off, you might want to keep the shell casing from it. But generally, those will have etchings if someone actually was intending to use it for, you know, because we've seen that in other cases. Just the whole thing is just lacking in what people do if they're going to do something horrendous like this. There's nothing that lines up.
There's just so much in this case where, okay, you're going to go down the road, whoever it is that's, oh, I found this piece of paper, let's look at Rick Allen, and they do. Okay, go look at Rick Allen. There's nothing wrong with, you know, let's track down leads and see if there's anything there. And they get all this information. They know these things, and yet they just keep trying to hammer the damn peg into the hole, no matter how it doesn't fit. To a reasonable investigator, I think you go, yeah, I mean, I'm glad we looked down this road, but clearly this is not our guy. But
his first interview was so telling, too. His first interview he gave is when I said it in him, because he was so – because the first thing you're looking for is you're looking for transparency. You're looking for openness. You're looking for both verbally, non-verbally, cell phones. I mean, so if they wanted his cell phone, you know, and he had everything right on the table in front of him. I mean, there was, like, no issue of trying to – hide anything, being coy. There was no deviations, and it was a good first interview of him. And I'm like, there's nothing here. I have no idea why they doubled down on him after that.
Because in their mind, the round was the link.
And they couldn't be wrong after they made their
wrong. They were desperate to solve this case. It was 5 years cold. The round for them was the end all be all. It was the piece of evidence that they'd been searching for, and that there was no change in their mind. And you didn't see that with Mullins in the first interview, but you saw it with Holman in the second. Right? I look like here's what I want to do. I want to have you two guys over to my house. And I want to watch with Robin and Tony, I want to watch that second video because I want to hear Robin's thoughts on it and yours, T, in terms of, like, from a Fed's perspective, like when you're watching that interrogation video, because that's where he's really coming at him hard, because Mullins used the Reed technique, but in a much more, like, low-key type of way, whereas Holman full blown, just ram the Reed technique down his throat. And, you know, Allen still never cracks, you know, right. And it's that thing where he's saying, and it goes back to your earlier point in our last segment, which if you guys haven't watched, you should go back and watch. We were talking about how Allen has little regard for himself. Everything that matters to him most in his life is his wife and his family, you know, and you hear that in that second interview, you know, where the only thing that pisses him off is when they mess with his wife.
Yeah.
You know, that's when the only time he gets heated is when they're going at Kathy, because go ahead, Robin.
Yeah. And on that, so if you look at the history of people that do these things to girls, young girls, they don't have that kind of relationship with that kind of caring towards their wives or spouses or even significant others. It just is non-existent. Yeah. And so if we can go on the premise, because it's her optic as well as his optic, that this marriage and this relationship is everything to them, how do these actions he took benefit that relationship, or does it hinder it? And so even if it is some sort of sickness in him, there would have been leakage way before the stem. It just doesn't happen. It just – I can't keep saying enough. It just doesn't happen. It's not even outliers. There's no even outliers on this one.
No, there really isn't.
You know, there's so much value in that. You know, because you did the damn thing. You know, it's one thing for me as a defense attorney to be sitting here screaming and hollering. It's another thing for a guy who did the damn thing. And you know, I mean, you were out there. You're learned in the ways of how these guys operate in a way that it gives credence to what I think everybody that's on the side of, like, Allen's not the guy. You know, and it's validating for me to hear. Anytime that I have somebody that was in that business, namely the FBI, that is echoing what we've all been saying, you know. So I thank you for that, man. It really it makes me feel better about a lot of things. So,
well, thanks. And because all we do every day is we look for outliers of behaviors, we look for outliers of everything. And I'll tell you, when I even first saw this case at the very, very beginning that Tony and I started first covering it, was the outlier is Allen's relationship with his wife.
Yeah.
That's an outlier. I have not seen any behavior like that in interviews. And then when you cascade on all the other things, like the confession, the solitary, all these things, the round, everything kept emphasizing not the guy. And then when you just, again, everything comes down to me, you start with relationships. In my line of work, the first thing I asked was, is this guy liked or not liked? How the relationships, and this is always the first thing to do, is I got to look at the relationships in life, because that's going to give me a clue about how serious we need to look at this person versus this person, this person versus this person, because happy people don't do bad shit. Right. And good, healthy relationships typically don't either. Doesn't mean all bad relationships do, but that's where you're going to start focusing. And when you have the type of relationship that we saw on display multiple times, tears, genuine emotion between both parties, including daughter, it's just completely.
And I'm here to tell you, Robin, like, so when I was covering that trial, and we covered, you know, the whole thing from beginning to end, from arrest through trial. And, you know, I became close with the Allen family, you know, not just Kathy, but Rick's mother and Rick's stepfather, Ken, who had raised him, who he considers to be his father. And these are like salt of the earth, like just the most down to earth people that you'll ever know. And I'm not talking about just niceties, like, hi, how you doing? I'm talking about, like, we ate lunch every day together during the trial. I sat next to them during the trial. I really got to know these people fundamentally. And I asked, Kathy, a lot of hard questions, you know, and the one thing that absolutely shone through about that is that these are two people that were married for 35 years, and there wasn't one fiber of Kathy that believed that Rick not only didn't do this, but that was even capable of it, you know, and you are not pulling the wool over somebody's eyes that you've been with since you were in high school for 35 years. I'm sorry. It's just not going to happen. You know, you're going to see a crack in that facade. Like, if I'm asking Kathy questions, you know, was there anything ever kind of like off about some shit? Was there some shit? Because when you look at like Asa Huerman,
right? That's the exact one. Yeah. There's no secret place. There's no secret room. There's no secret place.
He's not full Rex. No.
Right.
No. That's what that looks like.
Yes.
And that is not.
It's a perfect compare and contrast.
Yeah. I love one of the comments I saw on here. These cops aren't even good at being bad at what they do, I think is what it's. I just lost it. But it's like, yeah, that's true. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube on this piece of our conversation. We'd love to hear your feedback.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.